Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. This weekend, a video surfaced that purported to show ISIS leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi preaching at a mosque in Mosul in Iraq, or as he would have it, Mosul in the Islamic State or caliphate that he rules as caliph. It's a bold claim from a group that, with seeming lightning speed, has put together a military, revenue, territory, and huge claims on the entire Islamic world. Is this a mirage, a pawn, for real, fleeting? This hour on Point, understanding ISIS and its claim of an Islamic state, a caliphate. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What do you see emerging here? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Beirut in Lebanon is Rania Abuzaid, independent journalist covering the Middle East. She's been following the rise of ISIS in depth. Her big piece in Politico magazine is The Jihad Next Door, The Syrian Roots of Iraq's Newest Civil War. Rania Abuzaid, welcome to On Point. Thank you very much for joining us. Hello, Rania, are you there? We'll work on that line. Also with us from New York is Tanasi Kambanis, former Baghdad bureau chief and Middle East bureau chief for the Boston Globe, now a fellow at the Century Foundation. He writes the internationalist column for the Globe. His latest is The Surprising Appeal of ISIS. His new book out next year is Once Upon a Revolution, an Egyptian story. Tanasi Kambanis, welcome back to On Point.
Great to talk to you, Tom.
Tanasi, let me come first to you on this video from over the weekend. It's all over the web, easy to find. You can see it anywhere. You can see it at our website. And it purports to be al-Baghdadi giving a kind of Pope Francis-style address to, in this case, the Islamic world. Some in the Iraqi government have said, no, that's not him. I'm reading an American official telling the New York Times, somebody with a lot of experience in Iraq, says it does appear to be him. What do you think? What have you heard? Is this the caliph?
I mean, first of all, I'm sure he would not like you to call him Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi anymore, because he has come out as Caliph Ibrahim, and they're quite touchy about being addressed the way they want to be addressed, and that's sort of part of their project of really thinking of themselves in world historical terms. Now, about this speech, I have no reason to think it isn't him. There have been reports that his MO is to, for example, when he would go give orders, he would show up with three other people and they'd all have their faces hidden. And then afterwards, the person would be told one of those men was the leader. But I think that they have an illusion or delusion or conviction of grandeur, and they really think they're building a new epochal state. And so I think both from what he said and how he said it, that this would be the coming out speech of the Islamic State. I mean, it was much less fiery than one would expect, and at the same time, it was quite bold.
Like everything with ISIS or the Islamic State, this video was pretty well put together. It shows the interior of a mosque in Mosul. The caliph, if that's who we're talking about, al-Baghdadi, up on a kind of balcony speaking to people who are kneeling or sitting below. Let's listen to just a little bit. He's very calm. He's very assured. Seems very at ease with himself. And here he is speaking about his role as leader of the caliphate. Saying here, it's a burden to accept this empowerment, to be in charge of you. I'm not better than you or more virtuous than you. If you see me on the right path, help me. If you see me on the wrong path, advise and halt me and obey me as far as I obey Allah. They're purportedly the caliph of the new caliphate. Who is he speaking to? What's the message? What's the moment here, Tanasi?
Well, this is, in their view, they have finally restored what was lost when the Ottoman Empire fell, which is a single unified leader for, as they see it, all Muslims. And now, let's remember, this is a very exclusionary and sectarian view of what is a Muslim. I mean, they don't include the Shia or the Ismailis or the Alawites or any of the, as they see them, heretical offshoot sects.
Which is Sunni anchored.
this is a Sunni and a certain kind of Sunni that they appeal to. Now with that caveat, they are talking about bringing back an unapologetic, proud to be Islamic, proud to be its own civilization, state that can hold its own against the West and doesn't need to apologize for its backwardness or for its religiosity, and a state which, crucially, in their view, can unify physically, literally, geographically, economically, all the entire Ummah from West Africa to the Eastern Middle East.
Ummah meaning the sort of Islamic equivalent of Christendom. I mean, all
the
Islam.
Community. It means the mm-hmm. community. Mm-hmm. And this is the vision from the time of the Prophet. And of course, in his view, and I think the view of those who are attracted to this vision, that that would be an empire of formidable power and one which could really challenge Europe and the West in a way that hasn't happened in centuries.
We'll look at the origins of ISIS and where it stands now. It's critically important. But give us just a sense of the history and significance of the term, the framing, caliphate. What does it mean to Muslims? What does it mean when the caliph says it?
Well, right. So for those who are attracted to this idea, which again is I would suspect is in no way a majority of the Islamic world, the caliphate is the direct heir to the way the Prophet ruled the Islamic community. So when Islam came into being, there was the community of the faithful, that was the Ummah, and there was no separation between political life, economic life, and social life. There was and religious life. There was just one leader, the Prophet, and he led in all respects, and brought unparalleled success to his followers. I mean, if you remember the history, very quickly Islam spread from the Arabian Peninsula within less than a century to conquering the better part of the known world at the time. And ever since then, in the sort of the fundamentalist telling of Islamic history, ever since then, the community lost its way, became less faithful and less religious, and therefore entered into a long period of decline. So if one can restore the level of faith and intensity of the time of the Prophet, Islam can regain the kind of success that it had in its first century. That's the core of the idea of restoring the caliphate.
And there it sits, straddling Iraq and Syria, with reportedly $2 billion in the bank now, sources of revenue from oil and taxation, a military, though small and dependent on allies apparently, that swept across Iraq. Tanasi, does this look fleeting to you? Is this a moment's apparition, or is something real being established here to do with a caliphate or something like it in Western Iraq, Eastern Syria?
Well, I fear that it will be much more enduring than certainly I would like. This current iteration of the Islamic State comes out of al-Qaeda in Iraq, which was the small nihilistic group that did a lot of killing of Shia and of Americans about 10 years ago. It has learned a lot of lessons from its experience over the last 10 years. And in its current incarnation, dating back to the leadership of Abu Bakr or Caliph Ibrahim, if you prefer, that he took over in 2010, he has clearly determined that the group needs not to depend on foreign donations, and he has built an organization that is self-sufficient. They don't need rich patrons in the Gulf to give them bags of cash in order to put together suicide attacks. They have, as you said, a tax base. They have defensible borders. They have oil wells, electric plants under their control. They do business with the government of Syria. I expect they will do business with the government of Iraq as well because they have national assets that they have taken control of in which they can pawn or lease or sell the resources of back to the government. That is a sustainable model. And let's not forget, right, that they have American-built Abrams tanks that they captured in their last raid. They are real money, as you might say, and they have a sustainable way forward. So whatever happens to the political alliance of convenience with which they swept into Mosul earlier in this month, mm-hmm. Earlier in June, mm-hmm. Even if those allies abandon them, they will have the ability to last for years, if not decades, and they will be very, very hard to militarily wipe out.
Many are talking about Iraq breaking up, a Kurdish Iraq, a Shia Iraq in the southeast, and then this in the west, the northwest, Sunni Iraq. Why would that stay under ISIS or the Islamic State as they fashion themselves now? Back 10 years ago, as you say, al-Qaeda in Iraq, and we all remember al-Zarqawi there, ultimately, Sunni tribal leaders in this part of Iraq turned on them, threw them out. Why won't that happen again? Why aren't they just the icing on the cake of local Sunnis who will ditch them and say, preposterous, this is ours, get out?
Well, it will absolutely be contested, right? We already saw this in Syria where ISIS about a year ago started sweeping into a position of dominance in the so-called liberated areas of Syria. And in October of last year, the other Sunni groups began a civil war within the civil war against ISIS. And that's still being played out in Syria. We can expect a similar development in Iraq, and the question will be who wins, who is stronger. So it's absolutely clear to me that ISIS can't be wiped out. That doesn't mean they can't be marginalized by stronger, let's say, networks of tribes and old Saddam loyalists and Baathists who will have their own networks. But ISIS has some really serious built-in advantages. And one is their level of conviction. And the other is the, I'd say, tactical brilliance with which they have opportunistically built up the organization since 2003. And unlike any other Sunni group that I'm aware of in this space, they've really learned from their mistakes and built up something that militarily and socially is cohesive and scarily powerful. And that's an advantage to them.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking this hour to understand ISIS, the fighters, the self-proclaimed caliphate and Islamic State, who they are, what they mean. Video released last month by ISIS purported to show ISIS militants tormenting unarmed captured members of the Iraqi army, grabbing one of them by the hair. A militant says the Islamic Nation will slaughter you and you're an enemy of God. Not a pleasant scene by any stretch. Brutal, too brutal for al-Qaeda. Over the weekend, the video released claiming to be the new caliph, Caliph Ibrahim, calling on Muslims to join the fight, saying the foundation of our religion is a book that guides and a sword that leads to victory, saying we have to fight. Purportedly, the new proclaimed caliph there, standing in a mosque in Mosul, saying Allah has ordered us to fight his enemies and wage jihad for him to establish his religion. Allah said, I've ordered you to fight for Islam, even though you do not like it. Tanasi Kambanis joins us from New York, fellow at the Century Foundation. His forthcoming book is Once Upon a Revolution, an Egyptian Story. Rania Abuzaid joins us now from Beirut. Rania, I hope we've got you on the line there. Thank you for being here, Rania.
Thank you, and apologies for the technical difficulties.
Sometimes it cannot be helped. Tell us about the emergence of ISIS, how it moved from Iraq into Syria, how it flourished in Syria. How did that unfold, Rania?
Well, the Islamic State, formerly known as ISIS, is just the latest incarnation of a group that was called Al-Qaeda in Iraq, the Islamic State of Iraq. And about 5 months into the Syrian uprising, the ISI sent a group of 8 men across the border to set up a new al-Qaeda franchise in Syria. That franchise was called Jabhat al-Nusra. In April 2013, the ISI leader, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, then declared that he was merging his Iraq-based group with this new Syrian group, Jabhat al-Nusra, and calling this group ISIS or ISIL. Jabhat al-Nusra rejected this merger, as did the al-Qaeda chief Ayman al-Zawahiri. Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi defied Zawahiri and continued to operate under the name of ISIS or ISIL. And, you know, as the months went past, the group managed to seize territory in north and northeastern Syria, not so much from the Assad forces, but rather from other rebel groups who had, quote-unquote, liberated the area from the government. And it started to consolidate its hold, most notably in Raqqa City, which is the group's administrative capital, if you like, and it's the only one of Syria's 14 provincial capitals to have fallen from the regime's grip. And from that area, from that area of the northeast, if you like, ISIS fighters started to move rather freely between the Iraqi-Syrian border, and you know we saw them push forward in June through vast swathes of Iraq, taking Mosul and other cities as well.
Rania, talk about the brutality here that led Al-Qaeda itself, Al-Qaeda Central, Zawahiri, to distance itself from ISIS. We've seen, you can go to the web and easily see photographs of crucifixion, no small number, all kinds of brutality. What about that, and what moved Al-Qaeda to break off with ISIS?
Well, you know, the ISI, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, has long had a troubled relationship with Al-Qaeda Central, and that dates back to the early years of the Iraq War. We can see in the so-called Abbottabad Papers, which was a stash of correspondence that was found in Abbottabad, Pakistan, in Osama bin Laden's hideaway over there after he was killed, that there were many documents relating to Al-Qaeda's affiliate in Iraq and its perceived brutality. You know, Al-Qaeda realized that this group was, quote-unquote, tarnishing its reputation and that it was killing Muslims as indiscriminately as it was killing others. And this was a cause for concern among Al-Qaeda's leadership. In one of the letters, actually, the American jihadist, Adam Ghadan, actually suggests that the leadership cut all ties from its Iraqi Al-Qaeda affiliate. So that, you know, we see that this group has had a very troubled relationship with Al-Qaeda Central for at least a decade. Those troubles sort of came to a head in February of this year when Al-Qaeda Central completely disavowed itself of the group, and it said that it was not consulted ahead of its creation and that it is not responsible for its actions. So this has been brewing, if you like, for quite some time, but the level of sort of inter-jihadi fighting that we have seen since the beginning of this year, most notably in Syria and now also in the Iraqi arena, is really truly unprecedented.
Rania, stand by in Beirut. Tanasi, in New York, there's plenty of speculation that the Assad government actually restrained from attacking ISIS because it saw how extreme it was. It went after the Free Syrian Army, the more moderate ones. I guess the idea being that they saw that if ISIS arose, it would eventually get the rest of the world to back off and leave Assad in power because they would be worried about the rise of ISIS, Tanasi.
Yeah, this is an old blueprint of the Arab authoritarian states, right, which is allow only such an unpalatable opposition that moderate people will be forced to prefer the regime to the other alternative. And the Syrian so there's a lot of conspiracy theories that say that the Syrian regime actually created ISIS, and I don't think there's any evidence for that. But they certainly allowed ISIS to flourish. They reserved their bomber jets, for example, to go after the more reasonable and moderate opposition, and left ISIS unmolested. They've allowed ISIS free reign until recently through desert roads to go and attack other better opposition groups. And now, of course, the strategy has worked for the Syrian regime in some respects, but it's also backfired because ISIS is much, much stronger than anyone ever expected it to be. And I don't think it can be put back in the box so easily once they've finished, if they do finish, with the other opposition.
Rania, describe what happens socially when ISIS takes over a region, the kind of rules that people are obliged to live under.
Well, we can see what it did in Raqqa City, for example. I was in the Raqqa City very early after it fell from the regime hands. I was the first journalist to report out of there. And the offensive was led by other Salafi jihadi groups, most notably a group called Ahrar al-Sham, which is not affiliated to Al-Qaeda,
yep,
and Jabhat al-Nusra, which is. And, you know, these groups would suggest, for example, they were handing out pamphlets about what they considered appropriate women's wear. And it was basically the same thing that ISIS has imposed, and that is the all-enveloping black cloak and a face veil, not merely just the headscarf.
Mm-hmm.
And but they didn't impose it. That was the difference. They suggested it. And, you know, women could walk around freely in the markets. People still went about their daily business and things like that. I remember seeing Jabhat al-Nusra fighters posted outside the city's two churches, for example. And they were posted outside banks and other institutions to protect them and to prevent looting and things like that. When ISIS rolled into town and rolled into that territory in its big push to to dominate these rebel-held areas of Syria. The rules changed. They enforced the dress codes, for example. Women were not permitted to wear pants anymore in Raqqa city. They had to wear the niqab, the face veil. You know, prayers five times a day became mandatory and obligatory. The church that I saw in the middle of the city next to a public garden was turned into a dawah center for ISIS, which means a recruitment center for ISIS, and they removed the crosses from the churches. So it was a very different set of rules, and we also saw that in we've seen that in Mosul just a few days after ISIS and its Iraqi allies took control of Mosul. They also posted a similar set of rules, and you know, so very early on in their rule, they made it clear that this is the way that life is going to be in their interpretation of an Islamic state.
Tanasi, we've seen the images of crucifixion around Syria. Not with the old-style cross generally, but with kind of gallows and multiple men hanging there. We've seen plenty of videos that ISIS itself puts up of apparently ISIS blowing up mosques, Shia mosques, in Iraq, and no small number of them. The implication from Al-Qaeda Central is that they're too brutal, too extreme to last. What about that? Are they too extreme to last, Tanasi?
I'm not sure their problem is specifically with extremism as much as it is with their sectarianism, right? I mean, Al-Qaeda doesn't mind extremism against the correct targets. And what ISIS has done, or the Islamic State now has done, is it has become baldly Sunni in an area in which Shia Islam has been dominant now for at least since the U.S. conveniently toppled Saddam. And the Sunnis have been embattled and have felt like their leadership has been not really speaking for them effectively. So if you're a Sunni and you feel like you're being persecuted because of your sect and the only leaders you have are ex-Ba'athists, let's say, or tribal leaders who are either pretending not to be sectarian or sort of, you know, halfway sectarian. And suddenly you get a group that is willing to use violence without limit and which speaks to you directly as a Sunni and says, hey, let's stop pretending that this isn't sectarian. It's a sectarian battle of the ages, and we want to win it as Sunnis, not as pretend Arab nationalists or as Ba'athists or as Saddamists. We want to be Sunnis, and we want to win and be in control. That has, I think, a very profound appeal. And that is, in a way, what I think set off alarm bells in Al-Qaeda Central, because they know that a war against Islam by jihadists is not going to go well for them because they live in the Islamic world. And if they alienate all moderate Sunnis as well as all other sects, they're not going to last.
ISIS, so the Islamic State, calling for an all-in, all-out battle. Let me turn to our listeners, if I may. Jessamine is calling from Austin, Texas. Jessamine, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to share my experience, which is that the deep desire for the return of the Muslim caliphate, and in fact a form of mobilization, has been going on and been very widespread for a long time. In my experience, I was in London in 2006 when there were widespread demonstrations and riots concerning the depiction of the Prophet Muhammad mm-hmm. in a Danish cartoon. Mm-hmm. And at that time, I went down to Trafalgar Square and I had a chat with some of the protesters, and they were very clear, almost dispassionate about the fact that their movement was all about bringing back the Muslim caliphate.
And why did they want that, Jessamine? Why? For what?
I think it's as complex as when the Jews say next year in Jerusalem. It's a deep-seated return of the promise of their faith, of what they could be in the world socially and economically, and what the general and sort of natural order of the world should be, was the impression that I got. And it sounded like, talking to some of these protesters, very much like some of the guests, you know, what your guests have brought up. But it also included the belief that non-Muslims within these territories would go through a process in which they were first taxed. I guess this might be Sharia law, I don't know. And then if they continued to refuse to convert, they would all be killed. And this was just sort of part of the expansion of the empire in that way.
Of course, there are different records on that front in different caliphates through history. Jessamine, I appreciate your clarity and your call. Thanks for calling from Austin. Tanasi, I mean, you write about, and you've alluded to it here, but you write about how, for some, this experience of the Islamic State is a first taste in this region of something that feels like citizenship. This can sound to people outside the region kind of nutty. I mean, it's so extreme. They're massacring people by the road and crucifying people. It doesn't look like a calm civic citizenship. What flavor of citizenship are people finding here, Tanasi?
Well, so these states, these Arab authoritarian states have completely failed to deliver any kind of rights or sense of belonging or any mobilizing identity.
The post-colonial order of the last half century more.
Right. So any in that vacuum, anything that asks you as a subject, citizen, person to contribute, even the most minuscule thing, feels like an improvement. In this case, the mobilizing project of ISIS, I mean, they're asking people to enforce moral codes on their neighbors, report people who are corrupt, report people who don't follow the dress code, who don't pray. You are being drafted into a project, a state building project. And, you know, to me, it seems violent, nihilistic and destructive, but it is constructive in the sense that you are suddenly being asked to stand up and your vote counts in a perverse way. Your voice counts. You have a voice. You have a role to play. And let's also be clear that this is coming in a context where violence, horrible violence, has been endemic forever. Not forever, but for decades. Mm-hmm. And so the brutality of ISIS is not that much different than the Shia death squads who swept through Iraq in 2006, killing people with drills to the head.
Yeah.
Or the routine brutality of Saddam Hussein and Bashar al-Assad. So to a Sunni who's sitting in Raqqa, for example, or in Mosul, they might not look that much worse than what they've been dealing with for 10 or 20 years. And crucially, one other thing, and I'm curious to hear Rania's thoughts because she's been really up close with the folks who've lived under ISIS. I get a sense from refugees I've spoken to from those areas that there's a little bit more sympathy for ISIS than I expected to find. And in a way, what I hear people saying is, look, you know, I'm just a regular Muslim. I'm not that pious. And these guys are, you know, I don't agree with everything they say, but they're really trying to be better at this than I am. And so I have to respect them at least for the depth of their faith.
Rania, let us hear your view on that. Sympathy or fear, Rania?
No, I disagree with that. Respectfully, I don't think that, first of all, I think that we have to be careful when we talk about the Sunnis. You know, the Islamic State has a relatively small sphere of influence within the Muslim world. Yes, it holds vast parts of Syria and it has swept through a swathe of Iraq. But Islamism is a spectrum and the Islamic State has strong opposition even within the militant Salafi jihadi world, which is itself just one component of Sunni Islam. So first of all, I think we have to be careful when we talk about the Sunnis.
Yes.
Secondly, I don't think that the Islamic State is inclusive, and I don't think that it practices participatory politics. I think that the role of the citizen and its state is simply to obey within the strictures of that group's ultra-conservative interpretation of Islam. You cannot question or challenge it. It is like a dictatorship cloaked in religion. So I don't see it as inclusive, and I think that it rules by fear. And that's been my experience, reporting in Syria.
Do you see it as potentially? Do you see it as potentially enduring, Rania, or as fleeting? It's here for this.
You don't declare a caliphate every day, so presumably they, you know, when they decided to take this step, they did so and they based it on something. And they, I mean, you know, if you read the declaration of when they declared the caliphate, they even addressed the fact that they don't have much support even within the Salafi jihadi world, and the fact that most of the key jihadist ideologues who are living today have all come out against them.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point, and we are looking this hour to understand ISIS, the fighters, the self-proclaimed caliphate and Islamic State, who they are, what they mean. Rania Abu Zaid is with us from Beirut. Her big piece in Politico magazine is The Jihad Next Door, the Syrian roots of Iraq's newest civil war. Tanasi Kambanis is with us from New York, fellow at the Century Foundation, spent a lot of time reporting out of this region. Once Upon a Revolution, his book coming out next year. A week ago Sunday, here was the announcement via web video of the establishment of an Islamic caliphate leader, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. That is Caliph Ibrahim.
فقررت الدولة الإسلامية And so the Islamic State has decided with the elders and the emirs and the Shura Council to announce the establishment of an Islamic caliphate.
Interpreted there by AFP, Abbas is calling from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Abbas, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
For ISIS, I mean, I'm a Muslim, sir, and this is just sad for me. If it's ISIS or the Islamic State, they're taking over my religion. They're making me look bad. I don't think we should, even the U.S. or the government, we should not tolerate any of these people who are in support of ISIS. I came here to live in a free world, in a free country that gives me a freedom of religion. Don't want these people to come after me, just like they did in Iraq. I came from Iraq in 2009. I cannot live under them again.
Abbas, do you think that Muslims in the Middle East will end the Islamic State, this caliphate? Will Muslims themselves end it somehow, attack it, or do you think it may flourish?
The Muslims, if they want to win, they need to unite. The Sunni, the Shia, other Muslims from different countries, they need to unite. They're divided right now. That's why ISIS is strong. So after they unite, they can defeat ISIS.
Abbas says, this caliphate doesn't represent me. Abbas, I appreciate your call. One more from Iowa City, Iowa, Troy. Troy, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom. My thought is when you say, can it last, communists lasted pretty long under Stalin. And is this a problem, part of the blowback problem that Obama is facing for his support of the rebels in Syria? If he wouldn't have supported this, would this still be a problem? So it seems like it's a blowback problem on Obama for supporting the rebels.
Well, that's a touchy subject. We'll look at that, Troy. I mean, president's being criticized for not supporting enough, not supporting the moderates enough, but there's also talk about blowback. Ronnie, do you see blowback here? American investment in local forces now emerging as the Islamic State, or does that not make sense to you, Rania?
Well, a lot of folks that I speak to here are saying that there hasn't been any U.S. investment in the rebel forces, and that is one of the reasons why they say that Syria became a haven for more jihadi Islamist groups to emerge. So, you know, there are two sides to that coin, and that's a political question, which, as a reporter, I'm not comfortable answering.
And also, here's a question online. It says, tell us about the relationship between the CIA and ISIS. Now, of course, you can go back to al-Qaeda in Iraq, but is there a connection there, or is that conspiracy theory, Tanasi?
I think that's a conspiracy theory. The things that we do know for sure is that the U.S. has had a very sort of middling involvement in propping up the Syrian rebels. We also know that the U.S. has had a very deep involvement in propping up the Iraqi government and, you know, CIA, special forces, overt action. Those have been our sort of our proxies and our allies in this theater. We have been quite leading from behind, as the administration is wont to say, and that has left a big opening, a lot of disorder and entropy and vacuum, and that is what ISIS has opportunistically been able to seize. And now we're in a position where Obama, rightly or wrongly, wanted to step out of this theater as much as possible, away from Iraq, away from Syria, not get involved. And now we find that staying out of it is a choice that had its own consequences and which could paradoxically bring the U.S. back in more deeply than it ever wanted to be involved after 2010.
John McCain pouncing on that over the weekend on CBS Face the Nation with Bob Schieffer there. Here was Senator McCain blaming the rise of ISIS squarely on the Obama administration's policy in the region.
This didn't have to happen. This was a failure of United States policy. And by the way, there still is none that I can discern, either a policy or a strategy to handle this situation. This guy Baghdadi, when he left Camp Buka, the prison camp that we ran, he said, "See you in New York." We now have the largest and richest enclave of radical terrorism in history.
We'll look at what that may mean. Ahmed's calling from Atlanta, Georgia. Ahmed, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you so much. I appreciate the opportunity of giving me to speak. I think what I need to say is, quite frankly, is that we need to be very, very careful of alienating the rest of the Sunni community with all due respect. I mean, this group, ISIS, does not represent the vast majority of the Sunni community.
Okay.
And we don't want to seem like, especially in our country here in the U.S., we don't, our government, we don't want to seem like we're actually supporting one-sided of pretty much the Shia community and fighting against the Sunni. We need to be very careful how we handle this situation, because this group is very extremist and do not represent any Sunnis with all due respect. Most of us are very angry at the situation, how it ended in Iraq, meaning that the majority of the Shiites is pretty much not dealing with the with this group, with the Sunnis in Iraq, in giving them any kind of sharing power.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I want to talk about the caliphate. This caliphate thing, I mean, this is not the notion that we're making it seem like as it is a bad thing for to have a caliphate. Most, any Muslim would love to have a caliphate. The question is this group representing, are they the right people to do caliphate? The fact of the matter is, no, they're not. These people are extremists. These people are creating problems. They're killing among the Sunnis. They're killing everybody. They're invading nations. This is not the right way to do a caliphate. These people are not representing the Sunnis. But we don't want to create more problems as if we're supporting one side, and that would create more support for the ISIS.
Yeah, Ahmed, we've got it, and I so much appreciate your call from Atlanta. Rania, what about it? Ahmed, they're saying, look, this is not my style caliphate, but be careful, United States. How you attack, who you attack, who you ally with, you may turn even more against the U.S. How does the U.S. get involved here? Does it have to get involved? Is this a threat to the United States? If it does get involved, is it inevitably siding with Shia or with Iran in a region-wide conflict, Rania?
Well, it is, you know, it is becoming a region-wide conflict. We have so many different sides already involved between the Syrian-Iraqi border. We've got the Iranians and the Russians and the Assad regime on the one side, including Lebanese Shiite Hezbollah militants as well. And we've got, you know, Sunni states on the other side in Syria. And we've got this group ISIS, formerly known as ISIS, the Islamic State, in the mix there. And it's in the middle of an inter-jihadi war with Al-Qaeda and other groups. So it's one big mess. But just on the point of the caliphate, you know, I agree with your former speaker. Not all Sunni Muslims think that this is the group that is best placed to restore a caliphate. I was saying before the break that key jihadi ideologues have come out against this group, the Islamic State, and also we've heard from some who have come out against it, declaring the caliphate as well. You know, and it recognizes that. It knows that it doesn't have the support of key leaders within that community, and it has mentioned that. It has tried to appeal to Muslim honor, to claims of subjugation, persecution, and, you know, many of those feelings are real, and many Sunnis do feel those things, but it doesn't mean that they think that ISIS is the best place group to address those grievances. On the other hand, some people in the Salafi jihadi world and Sunni Islam think that this is a group that can get things done. It doesn't just talk about a caliphate or things like that. It actually does it. It implements things on the ground. So there are, you know, two very clear sort of sides to this issue.
I notice you're very careful to say Islamic State. I've read you, Rania, saying that in the Islamic State, if you now say ISIS, you're subject to a 70 lashes punishment. I mean, they're very stern about the language and the framing that they want.
That was actually, if you use their Arabic acronym, which is Daesh, they don't like when they were called ISIS, the Arabic acronym would have been Daesh, and they didn't like that. They wanted to be referred to as the state because they never viewed themselves as a faction, as a group. They always viewed themselves as a state, as a sovereign group, and that's why they didn't bend to mediation efforts from other jihadis who tried to mediate an end to the conflict between this group and Al-Qaeda, because they viewed themselves as superior to organizations, including Al-Qaeda, because Al-Qaeda is an organization, not a state. So that's just the mindset that they had.
Tanasi, if the Islamic State emerges, if it endures, does it necessarily, just by its existence, provoke a region-wide clash of Sunni and Shia?
There is already a region-wide clash of Sunni and, Sunni and Shia, and it is not the only cleavage and the only dynamic, but it's an important one. And what I'd really focus our attention on is the failure of of the idea of citizenship, the failure of the states in the region to create functioning states and inclusive, real, compelling ideas of citizenship. And because of that failure, any mobilizing group can step in, especially one which can appeal to a threatened and fundamental identity building block like Sunni identity or Shia identity.
But does this turn it into open war between Saudi Arabia and Iran, let's say, the leading Sunni power, the leading Shia power?
I don't believe that that's new. I mean, since the invasion of Iraq, where the U.S. was occupying Iraq and the U.S.'s tight ally, Saudi Arabia, was bankrolling jihadis and nationalist rebels who were attacking the Americans on sectarian grounds, also attacking the Shia-backed Shia government backed by the U.S., we've been in an open war for at least a decade. And what's new, in a sense, is that the Sunni, at least there are some now Sunni groups that are as sectarian as the Shia groups have been. And that is going to that kind of bloodletting is going to continue until some of these states successfully build some identity. I don't care what it is, but some kind of identity that is political based, or based in something, or even in a new read of religion that is inclusive enough to truly welcome Shia and Sunni or other sects as well. And until that happens, we're going to have this cleave, and that cleave is very, very generously bankrolled by Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Kuwait, and Iran. So on both sides, there's a huge bank account for this, and that's going to last, I think, for a long time.
But isn't it a threat to the Saudi royal family? Why would they be bankrolling? Isn't it a fundamental threat to their order?
I mean, I'm not on the same line as every analyst with my view of this. I actually think that there's deeper sympathy in the Saudi elite for Salafi jihadi fundamentalism than many people believe. And so I think that there's two things. One is that quite clearly they bankroll extremist groups abroad in order to try and control them and keep them from affecting them at home. But I actually think that after the post-Afghanistan blowback, had they really shared no ideological fellow traveling views with these groups, they would have stopped funding them, and they've continued to fund them quite generously for a quarter century after the end of the Afghan jihad. And that tells me that at least significant parts of the Saudi royal family more or less share the same ideology as the Salafi jihadi extremists.
And now the Islamic State with its own revenues, oil wells, taxation. Rich in West Palm Beach, Florida. Rich, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Yes, I believe that Al-Qaeda, ever since 9/11, they had planned to use the Quran verse of 9:12 to say that America should be attacked for interfering with the Islamic States of the Arab nation. So if you look up Surah 9:12, it'll say that if your enemy shall violate your covenant with Allah, they shall be attacked. That's all I have to say.
Rich, I appreciate your call. Rania, do you see a threat to the United States in all of this flux and change and violence in your region?
Well, I think at the moment the groups are more focused on the near enemy rather than the far enemy. I put that question actually to some Al-Qaeda in Syria men who I was with earlier this year, and they about what their foreign policy was and if they shared the same foreign policy, say, as Al-Qaeda Central. And to a man, they all said the same thing, that at the moment their fight is with their near enemy in the region, but that if any group should attack them, then they would respond in the region or elsewhere. So, you know, I found that very interesting. But at the moment, these groups are all involved in the mess that is in the region.
Tanasi, what about a threat to the U.S. here? How would you weigh it? And how much of the region could this conflict swallow up? Does Jordan get taken in here? Does it come right to Israel's borders? What happens then?
Yeah, I mean, I think the from the U.S. perspective, we need to remember that what the U.S. faces is a a terrorism threat that is best and most effectively dealt with through police and intelligence action. We actually have a quite good at this point mechanism for dealing with threats to the homeland, whether they come from the Pakistani Taliban or Al-Qaeda or elsewhere. So whatever threat the Islamic State generates to the U.S. homeland, I think there already is a structure in place to deal with it. The secondary threat, however, that we aren't dealing with is the U.S. interest in a stable, pluralistic, nonviolent Middle East. And I actually think that the U.S. benefits a lot from that and needs to really work with its allies there to keep the region from further spiraling into violence. Now, you just hinted at what's in the offing, and I think absolutely we saw the war in Syria spread back into Iraq last month. Jordan, I don't think will collapse into war, but is feeling huge amounts of strain. Lebanon is under a huge amount of strain, and all this will really affect our U.S. interests in the region.
I feel like we're opening a book with many pages and we're still in early chapters. Your notion that this is enduring, that this is not fleeting, that this will not simply be the Sunni tribal chiefs of Iraq turf quite soon gives us that sense, Thanasi. We will have to meditate a little on everything we've learned today and look forward at the same time. Thanasi Kambanis at the Century Foundation in New York. Look for his upcoming Once Upon a Revolution. Thank you for joining us today, Thanasi.
Great to talk to you, Tom.
And Rania Abuzaid, independent journalist covering the Middle East out of Beirut. She wrote The Jihad Next Door for Politico magazine. Rania, thank you very much for your insights today.
Thank you.
Listeners, thanks for being with us. Stay tuned. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.